Hello, I'm Troy Abels from Hanford, California, and you are listening to Gospel Tangents.
The best source for Mormon history, science, and theology. I'm Rick Bennett. What are the main differences between the first visions accounts? We're going to talk about that with Dr. Stephen Harper, author of The First Vision, Memory and Mormon Origins, and he will talk about some of the differences and similarities among the accounts and whether they can be trusted. Check out our conversation. So let's talk a little bit about the 1835 account. How is that different than both 1832 and 1838?
Excellent question. So the 1832 and 38 are autobiographies. They are strategic memories. And Joseph has stress and anxiety associated with strategic retrieval of his memory that he doesn't have when it's a spontaneous memory. So the 1835 telling is a spontaneous retrieval. Joseph's not planning to write anything. He's not planning to tell the story of his first vision. He's talking to this fellow from the East, right, Robert Matthews, and they start comparing prophetic credentials. This guy thinks he's a great spiritual leader. He's heard Joseph is, so he's come to see him, kind of compare notes. Maybe there's kind of a subtle competition going on between them, and I think at least Matthews is trying to figure out if he might ally himself with Joseph Smith in some way or other. So they're very curious about each other, and they want to know what's going on inside each other's brains. And they start swapping credentials for what makes them a prophet. And Joseph says, well, let me tell you how the Book of Mormon came forth. First thing that happened is I was worried about matters that involve eternal consequences. And I worried about it a lot. I had great anxiety. I was distressed and perplexed. And I went to the woods to pray, saw a fire, and then one personage who revealed another, filled me with joy unspeakable. And it's a fast-moving, relatively easy flow for Joseph, right? When you compare it to the autobiographies, you notice that it's not freighted with the concern about writing. The first thing Joseph does in both of his autobiographies is offers a disclaimer about why he can't write well.
So the 1835 is not written by Joseph.
That's
it's written
right.
by this
Warren Parrish. Captures it and gets
Parrish.
It into his journal. Joseph's not writing it. He's not thinking about writing it. He's not thinking about what's the beginning of the story, the middle of the story, the end of the story. How do I structure this narrative? He's just telling, just spilling it out. And it comes naturally to him. In that sense, it's much easier work for him when he tells it like that than it is when he writes it. And we now know that he tells it like that quite a bit in this middle 1830s period, much more than we used to think, right? He's telling it that way by shortly after, if not at the same time or before, he writes the 1832 autobiography. So the 1835 memory is really cool. And I think one of the most telling things about it is it doesn't seem to cause Joseph Smith the psychological need to reconcile with or deal with that Methodist minister's rejection. So one of the things I argue in the book is that the 1832 memory is an effort to make good with, or at least not offend, the minister or the whole world the minister represents. And that Joseph isn't very satisfied with his memory as a result of that effort. And then I argue that the 1838 memory is an effort to take that minister head on. This is Joseph in the worst year of his life. He is in a persecution mindset. Notice how many times that account says hot persecution, the bitterest persecution.
Well, I know Dan Vogel mentions that well, yeah.
It is definitely... The present that gives us that version of the past is saturated with persecution. And in that mode, Joseph Smith spits venom at the clergy, right? He calls the Methodist priests three times. He knows that that's a way to offend, right?
Because they're Catholic, comparing to be Catholic to priests, is that right?
Right, the people who are not liked very much, like the Latter-day Saints in Protestant America in the 1830s, are Catholics. So if you want to call a Methodist a name, a Methodist clergyman, you call him a priest. and, you know, compare him to the hireling priest. You label him with those mean names that people call Catholics. I think Joseph knows he's doing that when he does it. And from the first line, owing to the many reports put in circulation by evil disposed and designing people, I'm going to tell you the truth. And then Joseph tells the story, and then notice that interpretive memory. The last fact he gives us, the last piece of factual memory is, a few days after the vision, I was in company with the Methodist minister. I told him, and he rejected me. And then Joseph launches into this passage of interpretive memory about how it felt. And this is how it feels in 1838 to reflect on this whole history. When Joseph searches his past for the origin of persecution, it started with that rejection. And he interprets it. He internalizes it. It's heavy. It's traumatic. It's emotional. And that feeling that comes out of that 1838 memory is because of all those combining factors. The original rejection, all of the experience since, the persecution of the present, and Joseph remembering strategically in that context. He's pretty upset, and you can feel it as you read that.
Interesting. Tell us more about the 1842. I know Dan kind of collapsed 1838 and 1842 because he said they really weren't that different. Are there any differences there?
There's not a whole lot to, after the 38, which is intensely interesting for all kinds of interesting reasons, the 42 is sort of ho-hum. It's a response to John Wentworth's invitation for Joseph to provide his own story. So Joseph welcomes it. So this present is a whole lot more peaceful than the 1838 present, right? The 1838 present that gives us the past, as Joseph remembered it, is full of defensiveness to persecution and a response to that minister and all the opposition Joseph has faced ever since. Well, when it's a few years removed and Missouri is in the rearview mirror and Carthage isn't on the horizon, and you get a nice note from this prominent Chicago newspaper guy who says, hey, you've got some notoriety, and a buddy of mine's going to write a history of New Hampshire, and you spent part of your growing up years there. Why don't you tell us your own story? That elicits from Joseph a very calmed down, PR-based, PR-minded version of the story, with a little Latin thrown into it, right? This is Joseph trying to be his most refined self. And in this version of the story, God doesn't say all their creeds are an abomination. He says, as Joseph paraphrased it, he told me that all the churches were believing in incorrect doctrines, right? Same story, but with a different spirit, a different tone to it. Yeah. And I don't know that Joseph did that on purpose. It could be just the way we respond in a present. A much more pleasant present gives us a less embittered past.
So in 1838, let's talk about what all the things were going on. So that's when he got kicked out of Kirtland.
Yeah, right? So they start that account.
Yeah,
they start that account after he's driven from Ohio, leaves Ohio in the dead of the night, flees out of there, quite worried about how things are going to go, and arrives in Missouri just in time for things to fall out there. Yeah. So he starts that document.
Because Hans Mill was that same year as well.
That fall, exactly.
So that was quite a year. You got Hans Mill at the end.
Year of his life.
You got the bank crisis at the beginning.
And what we know is that Joseph started that 1838 history in 1838. He starts it before everything goes south in Missouri. But the document we have is an 1839 document. Even though it has an internal date that says 1838, it's an 1839 draft. So what we know is that between the first draft and the draft we have, the worst year of Joseph's life. Liberty Jail, Hans Mill, the siege at Far West, everything awful, the extermination order, right? And so that's the taste in Joseph's mouth when he puts that document together. And it's hard to tell exactly what comes from 1838 and what comes from 1839. But we can say with good accuracy that the context of the whole thing is bitter for Joseph.
And so that explains why he says all the churches are an abomination. He's using a lot of really emotional type terms.
I'm not positive that it explains it completely. I'm not sure that the Lord doesn't say all their creeds are an abomination. He may very well have said that. I would have said it if I were him, for good reason. But so I don't know. You know, there's no way for me to know for sure what exactly the Lord says in the vision. But I'm saying that I think a sound way to interpret the tone of the 1838 document is to see it in the present context of the worst year of Joseph's life. And that may give us the sort of the defensive, defiant, all their creeds are an abomination kind of tone that we have to it.
And then by 1842, things are semi-calm, and now that he hasn't really started doing polygamy yet, so...
No, he's started
that. I mean,
he
has, but it's secret at the time.
Right. Another way to see what I'm saying here is that we now have what we call a fair copy of the 1838-39 document. This is a Howard Corey draft of the same document. It comes from around 1840-41. So again, it comes from a period when Missouri is fading into the background and Carthage is not on the horizon yet. It's a peaceful lull. Nauvoo is a place where we've got a charter that protects us, right? Where we've been welcomed into the state. It's just such a different feeling from Missouri. And in that present, Joseph cuts off the defensive beginning of the document. It just says, I was born in Sharon, instead of owing to the many reports put in circulation by evil. And then, interestingly too, that big interpretive memory at the end, after he says, I was rejected by the Methodist minister, and it felt like I was Paul before Agrippa, and I knew it, and I knew God knew it, and that part's all gone too. And it's just the factual memory. Almost the exact same factual memory, but the interpretive parts, the parts that reflect the defensive present of 1838-39, he says, those don't feel right. They don't feel quite the same in the 1840-41 present. And I think that's the reason why those bookends are gone. So it's a useful way to see this point about memory and how memory works. We make memories out of our present and our past. And the feeling of the present has a lot to do with the tone, the spirit of the past that we recall. It's not that the facts are wrong necessarily, but the way the facts are presented and interpreted and the meaning that you breathe into them, even with the vocabulary, is very much dependent on the mood we're in when we remember.
I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Dr. Stephen Harper. Our next conversation with him will be our last, and we'll talk about some modern critics. So you need to sign up for our newsletter for free at gospeltangents.com/newsletter, and I will send you a secret link and see how he addresses some of our modern critics.
And John DeLynn, interestingly, has sort of migrated, right? He started out with a hermeneutic of trust in Joseph Smith, and then over time he's migrated to a position of extreme suspicion.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to hear the entire interview uncut, sign up at patreon.com/gospeltangents, and for $5 a month you can hear the entire interview without any interruptions. If you'd like to see the whole video, that's just $8 a month, and you can sign up either at youtube.com/gospeltangents or on our website at gospeltangents.com and click the yellow subscribe button, or you can go to patreon.com/gospeltangents, and I'll just need to make sure that we're Facebook friends, and I'll add you to our insiders group, and you can see the entire interview uncut. If you'd like to get PDF transcripts of our interviews, those are just $10 a month, and for just $15 a month, I will send you paperback versions of our transcripts as soon as they come out. Or, of course, you can buy them on Amazon as well. Go to Amazon.com and do a search for Gospel Tangents interview, and you can see all of our transcripts there. Don't forget to sign up for our updates at facebook.com/gospeltangents. Of course, you can follow us at Gospel Tangents on Twitter. To hear our interviews updated to your podcast player, go to tinyurl.com/gospeltangents and make sure you give us a 5-star review. And of course, you should show your support for Gospel Tangents with one of these cool t-shirts, like this green one, or light blue, sport gray, royal blue, purple, of course black, beautiful gold, and of course Utah red. I've probably left out some colors, but if you want to see more, go to gospeltangents.com/shop and you can get one of these. So once again, thanks for listening. Click here to subscribe, here for a transcript, and over here we've got some more of our great videos. Thanks again.